This broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Luxman Ireland House, NYU, is paid for by Luxman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flanley Promotions Limited. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. Coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray and I am your host on Saturdays from 9am to 10am Eastern Standard Time. Luxman Ireland House is New York University's Centre for the Study of Ireland and the Irish Diaspora. It was founded in 1993 by Loretta Brennan Luxman and her late husband, Louis L. Luxman. We teach, research, archive, provide public programs, and generally educate our community on the Irish experience at home and abroad. We come to you every week from our home on Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm thrilled to have a chat to Ireland's ambassador to the United States, Daniel Mulhall. I'm speaking to Dan today in the context of a new book. It's called Ulysses, A Reader's Odyssey. It's been published this week in Ireland by New Island Books. And in a way, one could say that this publication truly kicks off the centenary of the publication of Ulysses, which is coming up at the start of February. And it's really wonderful that someone close to home for us, someone we know rather well, is kicking that kind of celebration, commemoration off. For most of you, you will know, if you haven't read Ulysses, you will know how significant a text it is in literature, in world literature. We have the great honor of claiming it as something of our own, of course, because it was written in and about Dublin. And it was written by James Joyce, an Irishman, and we're exceedingly proud of the impact that Joyce has had. And I suppose my chat with Dan today demonstrates in a way the reach of literature, the potential reach of literature in terms of drawing attention to a place or a people. I'm always struck myself by how significant Ulysses and Joyce is in literary circles. For people then, and I'll pick up on that a little bit with Dan, for people who aren't coming from a family connection or some kind of ethnic connection to Ireland, for whom this really important text is significant in and of itself, outside of its Irishness. And in that way, it's a really wonderful example of how, again, we are elevating or amplifying themes of Irish society and Irish history in a literary setting in a really, really fun way. And, you know, as a writer myself, as an author, as a historian, it's unimaginable for most people who put pen to paper in a formal sense to think that a book that was written 100 years ago would be still as impactful as it is. It's widely read. Bloomsday in June is widely celebrated. And Joyce is studied alongside some of the other giants of literature on a world stage. And I'm not a Joyce scholar. I'm not a literary scholar myself. I wonder how much, if ever, Joyce thought about the lasting legacy of what he was doing when he put pen to paper with this rather extraordinary book. And I suppose with the times that we have in terms of discussions around a change in Dublin and the impact that COVID-19 and the pandemic has had on Dublin and changes to Dublin in terms of an emphasis or gearing towards tourists and what that means and the accessibility of the city for Dubliners, you know, for people. The Dublin that Joyce writes about is a city that's inhabited
right into the city core by people, and in keeping with many cities in recent history, Dublin is not like that anymore, and I think we're doing some reflections what it means to claim a city, and, you know, how do we find that balance between it serving the needs of its retail needs and its economic needs, and that it is a place for ordinary people to live. And this isn't just an issue in Ireland. So Dan has been in the US for, I guess now we'll be calculating, over 3.5 years now, 4 years, and it's a really nice opportunity to chat to him in the context of Ulysses, A Reader's Odyssey, about how his own diplomatic career has been shaped by literary figures, and he talks a little bit about what he does as an ambassador, what he does as a diplomat, and I talked to him about his kind of, you know, social media presence in terms of how he, you know, engages with Irish poetry and things like that to draw attention to the richness of Irish literature beyond James Joyce. And it's really a nice opportunity to chat to him and for him to take time out of a busy schedule. It's a demanding role. You know, it's not a position that means that you have a lot of downtime, and the engagement with other diplomats and Congress and politicians and labor leaders and, you know, intellectual, public intellectuals, et cetera, et cetera. It's really great to have this chat to him about all of that. So I'm handing over now to my conversation with Ambassador for Ireland to the United States, Daniel Mulhall. Enjoy this, folks. It's great. It is my great honour and pleasure to welcome to have a chat to me today the current ambassador. I must try and get the title right. The ambassador for Ireland to the United States, which is probably not right, but Daniel Mulhall. Dan Mulhall is here with me today, actually from Washington DC. First of all, Dan, thank you so much for taking time out. I've always a busy schedule for you to chat to me.
You're very welcome. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Miriam.
And today, my, as I say, my excuse to chat to you today, Dan, and congratulations on this beautiful publication, timely publication and important publication, Ulysses, A Reader's Odyssey. It's published by New Island Books. It's out this week, and I'm really thrilled that through the medium of This Irish American Life that we're able to have a chat to you today about this. Again, congratulations, Dan, and congratulations to New Island Books on the production end of it. The publication end of it looks really great. Tell us a little bit. I love how you've set up in the introduction, in the front piece material of Ulysses, A Reader's Odyssey, contextualizing your journey with Joyce, or with Ulysses in particular, in the backdrop of you as a diplomat over 4 decades, in the spirit of contextualizing this book and its publication. Dan, tell us a little bit about your journey and what this book sets out to do.
Okay, well, look, I mean, my association with Joyce goes back a long way. I remember as an undergraduate at UCC in the English department there, and I was studying English and history. So I was I was set a mini thesis to write, and I wrote my mini thesis on the Christmas dinner scene in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, which, as you'll recall, is a wonderful 5 or 6 pages of prose and wonderful dialogue. And it's a debate over the Christmas dinner table. We've all had those. Or even the Thanksgiving dinner table here in America, I suppose. And it obviously happened sometime in the 1890s or the early, probably the 1890s sometime. not long after the death of Parnell. And in this scene, Joyce's father, or Simon Dedalus as he is in the book, who appears also in Ulysses, and his friend, have a flaming argument with Mrs. Dante Reardon, because Mrs. Reardon is one of those who turned against Parnell, and she sided with the bishops in condemning Parnell for his immorality. And it's a fantastic insight into the passions that that particular period in Irish history ignited all over Ireland. And that gave me my first sense of James Joyce. Remember, I said I was a literature and history student, and it gave me that sense of a bridge, Joyce being a bridge between literature and history. And so ever since then, I've been fascinated by that coincidence between the great flowering of Irish creativity in the early part of the 20th century with W.B. Yeats, James Joyce, John Millington Synge, Sean O'Casey. An extraordinary flowering of literary excellence from a small island off the coast of Europe. And the fact that that flowering coincided with the flowering of Irish history and the culmination of the national struggle for independence in 1922, and the symbolic handover of the keys to Dublin Castle to Michael Collins, which you will recall is dramatized in by Liam Neeson playing Michael Collins in Neil Jordan's film Michael Collins. That handover of Dublin Castle took place about 12 days before the publication of James Joyce's Ulysses. So it's always struck me that there's a fascinating link there between the great modernist novel, one of the finest achievements by an Irishman of the entire 20th century, and the emergence of what I would call the first modern state. Now, why do I call Ireland the first modern state? Well, here's why. Because unlike the other countries that emerged as independent nations in the wake of the First World War and the Treaty of Versailles, all of those nations emerged from the ruins of the defeated empires, of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, the Russian Empire, the Turkish Empire. Ireland was the one country at that time that actually managed to prize itself free from one of the successful nations in the First World War, from Britain. Still at that time, probably along with the United States, the most powerful nation on earth. And yet our independence struggle managed to force the British government to concede independence to at least part of the island of Ireland, which would have been unthinkable 10 years before. So that's why, and that Irish achievement resonated all over the world, and many countries found the Irish story to be an inspiration to them when they, in turn, came to the brink of independence and started to push for independence from the former colonial powers. So that's why I say that Ireland, to me at least, I argue, Ireland is the first modern state, and Ulysses is the great modernist novel. So I think there is a certain kind of symmetry there between the emergence, the publication of Ulysses, and the emergence of the Irish Free State in 1922.
So what was all good books, then, as you know, there's usually some kind of light bulb moment, or was it, you know, for, you know, people who aren't aware, we're starting to really come into the throes of the centennial of the publication of Ulysses. What was the kind of spark? Because a book of this caliber doesn't come about easily or overnight. There's a lot of work, a lot of research, a lot of writing, a lot of editing, as you know. Was there a trigger, Dan, in terms of you kind of bringing your own journey with Ulysses into a dialogue with, you know, what we can present to a wider readership, and a wonderful tool and engagement with this important text?
Yes, I suppose America was the spur for me. And you know why? Because in my first year here, I traveled widely around the country. And I visited a lot of libraries. And guess what? I saw a large number of copies of the first edition of James Joyce's Ulysses, treasured possessions of libraries all over the United States. And my first year here, I was invited by the Rosenbach Museum and Library, which holds the original manuscript of Ulysses in Philadelphia, to take part in their annual Bloomsday reading. It's a 10-hour affair. Starts at 10 in the morning, finishes at 8 in the evening on the weekend closest to the 16th of June. And they close the streets. And they have 10 hours of a street party, effectively, with food stalls and so on, designed to celebrate Joyce's Ulysses. I remember thinking, hey, this is another illustration, and I've had these illustrations throughout my career, of the power of Irish literature to introduce and to foster an interest in Ireland on the part of people who would otherwise have no affinity with us. And I started to think, well, what could I do to help people to add to this interest in Joyce? And I thought, well, why don't I start writing a blog? So in 2019, I started writing a blog. And at the pace that I was going at, I probably would have finished in 2025 had it not been for the intervention of the global pandemic, which of course meant that from a situation where I was out as ambassador attending events 6 nights a week, for my first 2.5 years in Washington. Suddenly for a year and a half, I spent every night at home, hardly had any activities in the evening. So I decided that I would put the foot on the accelerator and that I would try to turn this blog into a book, which is what I've done. So I put a lot of effort into it. All of it, you know, at night and weekends and in my leisure time, not a word of this book was written during normal working hours. I separate completely the work I do, although I believe the two things are connected because I see this as an exercise in soft power diplomacy. If I go to Philadelphia and read and talk about Joyce to a big audience there of Philadelphians, that is going to encourage them to have a positive view of Ireland, and that's what soft power diplomacy is all about. It's about winning friends around the world, and our literature and our culture does that for us in spades, and I'm happy to be an exponent of what I call cultural diplomacy or literary diplomacy.
So Dan, tell us, for people who are listening to this conversation or watching this conversation, what did you set out to do? What do you set out to do in Ulysses, A Reader's Odyssey? What's your remit?
Well, I've aimed it at the general reader, mm-hmm. at someone who has maybe read Ulysses once but might be going back to it a second time because of the centenary. And I feel this would be a help to read my book alongside reading Ulysses. It's also for people who maybe have decided, hey, it's about time I read Ulysses. And my book, I think, can be help them because it describes my journey with the book. It's also for a reader who maybe started Ulysses, couldn't get through it, as looking for a bit of help to try and maybe start the journey again. And I make it clear in this book that if you find parts of Ulysses hard going, skip it. Move on to the next chapter. Don't be deterred, because it is, in a sense, an uneven book. Because it's written in so many different styles, some of the styles are quite accessible and quite wonderful, in my view. Other episodes, and they're called episodes rather than chapters, as you know, other episodes are rather difficult. And I think, rather than somebody giving up on Ulysses, for example, when you start, when you turn the page to episode 3, the Proteus episode, and you meet the phrase, the ineluctable modality of the visible. And then it goes on. And that's, I believe, at least, that many, many efforts to read Ulysses come unstuck in the sand on Sandy Mount Strand in episode 3 of Ulysses. And I say, well, read through it, or maybe listen to that chapter on the wonderful RTE podcast, which is a 1982 dramatization of Ulysses, which is brilliant. And that chapter comes to life in that format. But reading it may be a bridge too far for many people. And I say, don't be ashamed. Move on to chapter 4, episode 4, which is brilliant, because there you meet Leopold Bloom and Molly Bloom, who are far more engaging characters than Stephen Dedalus, who frankly is a bit of a nerd and a rather sort of bumptious young intellectual. I think he's Joyce's portrait of what he could have become had he not matured in the way he did and had he not moved to Trieste and taken on a different form of life from 1904 onwards. I think it's a portrait of the artist as an outsider, and Joyce decided to move to a place where he could pursue his artistic vocation in a way that he wouldn't be held back by what he called the nets of language, religion, and nationality, which he described brilliantly in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man.
Can I ask you, Dan, as someone who's had, you know, this amazing career as a diplomat over many decades, and I suppose in particular, and speaking to the point you made of how the American context influenced you in terms of thinking about, you know, what has culminated in the book, do you see ways in which we celebrate Ulysses and or Joyce being different in the diaspora to how it is in Ireland? You know, how does it work that way from your vantage point in terms of how it moves, I suppose, outside of the island of Ireland as a cultural reference point?
Yeah, well, I mean, here's where I would explain that. I think that in Ireland, we read Ulysses because we see ourselves as a people on the pages of Joyce's great book. And it's a forensic examination of Irishness at a particular time in our history. I think that's important, that it is situated at a particular time in our history. But nonetheless, it has a resonance with us today. Outside of Ireland, it's a different story, I think, because a lot of Joyce enthusiasts outside of Ireland are not part of our diaspora. They are, if you like, part of the affinity diaspora. So, for example, when I was in Germany, I met some wonderful Joyce enthusiasts there who, you know, had no connection with Ireland other than they loved the work of James Joyce. So I do think it's a different story. I think that Joyce outside of Ireland has the capacity to draw people into our orbit that wouldn't otherwise come in there if it wasn't for their enthusiasm for Joyce. And I mean, when I have my annual Bloomsday event here in Washington, D.C. every year, I had it virtually one year, but other than that, I've had it in person every year. And we get a great cross-section of people who come along. And, you know, I had, for example, this year, I had the EU ambassador, who's Greek, read the Odyssey, read the first page of the Odyssey in Greek and English for me. So, you know, it does bring people in. I mean, the ambassador of Cyprus here is a fervent Joyce enthusiast. A lot of people, you find, have read and know about Joyce because it's a bit like Mount Everest, you know? White people climb Mount Everest because it's there and it's a challenge. And for many people, it's an enjoyable challenge. Not for everyone. And by the way, I forgot to mention that I also see my book as for people who will never read Joyce, but would like to know something about Ulysses. And I think my book gives an introduction to Ulysses. It quotes me Ulysses quite a lot. I think of it as, you know, the quotes I have there are like a greatest hits package, you know, it's a kind of a, it's like a Spotify playlist, you know, it's a, I try to bring out some of the more, you know, the more enjoyable bits and put those on the page. So I think that even people who have no intention of reading Joyce or Ulysses will probably get something out of my book. I hope they do anyway.
Was there a particular episode or section of it in terms of your writing, your own writing, Dan, that was more challenging than others or more demanding for you?
Yeah, I mean, the chapter that I find most difficult, personally, I think a lot of people probably have the same experience, are Proteus, episode 3. Oxen of the Sun, which is extremely long, and Sirens, which has all this sort of, you know, musical language, which, you know, is yeah, I can see the point of it, but it's a pretty long, it's pretty difficult for the average reader or even for someone like me who's familiar with the book. I find it a challenge to get through it. And then also, of course, I think that, you know, the Scylla and Charybdis chapter as well, in the National Library, is very, very, I think, demanding for people who are ordinary readers. Whereas I think, I mean, I do say in the book that if you don't feel you can climb Mount Everest, but you want to get to the foothills, read chapter episode 1, which is very accessible, like a short story, really. And I say to people in the book, treat Ulysses like 18 short stories. Now, some of them are more like novellas, and in one case, Circe, it's a play. But nonetheless, treat them as separate projects, right? So I say read episode 1, episode 2, set in the school in Dalkey, where Joyce taught for a while in 1904. Episode 4, where you meet Leopold Bloom and Molly. Episode 6, where Bloom attends the funeral of Paddy Dignam at Glasnevin Cemetery, which is, I think, extremely funny, although it's about a funeral, but it's kind of got lots of black humor and is very readable. Episode 8, Lestergonians, part of which takes place in Daily Burns Pub. Daily Burns Moral Pub, where he has his lunch. Read my favorite, the Cyclops chapter, episode 12. I actually like episode 16, Eumaeus, which is set in the cabman shelter near Butt Bridge, and which features Skin the Goat Fitzharris, who is supposed to be, but might not be, the man who drove the cab, for the Invincibles when they murdered Lord Frederick Cavendish in Phoenix Park in 1882, which I've written about in the Irish Times recently. And then, of course, you have to read Molly Bloom's soliloquy, the 60 pages of Molly's thoughts. And it's brilliant. I mean, okay, some people are intimidated by the lack of full stops and commas and so forth, but I think you get used to it after a while, and it's definitely worth persevering with. It is one of the most brilliant pieces of writing in the whole of modern literature, in my opinion.
Dan, I'm showing my ignorance as a non-literary scholar and as a historian. I'm not as adept as you are in terms of like the connections at times. But in the literature, you know, there are so many books on Ulysses, so many books on Joyce, etc., etc. Has this approach in terms of kind of breaking it down and making it more manageable in this really engaging style that you use, has this been done before in other books, or is it new?
I assume you're
familiar with the literature.
Because I was, you know, locked down here for a year and a half or whatever. But I had access to my computer. I ordered a lot of books. So I ordered a lot of the classic sort of studies of Joyce and Ulysses. And frankly, most of them I felt were written for an academic audience, to be quite candid. And I felt some of them made the novel more complex, made it seem more complex than it really ought to be. And I was trying to correct that trend, to write a book that I thought anyone could read. I mean, first of all, it is not a guidebook in the standard sense. I don't go through each episode and annotate references obscure. I write about it from my own point of view. I pick out things I think are interesting. I try to enlighten people about what the chapter is trying to do and what it says and the style in which it's written. But it doesn't pretend to be a comprehensive. I mean, there's books that will come out this year. I think there's an annotated. There's a book of annotations coming out, which is probably going to be 500, 600 pages long. Mine is not like that. Mine is a story about the book. And the first chapter of my book is about my own journey with Ulysses. The second chapter is based on a lecture I gave down in Florida there a few years ago. And I do it as a Q&A. I do it as a tour. So I'm a tour guide guiding people through the novel. Then I have one chapter on each of the episodes of Ulysses. But again, written to tell a story about the episode rather than to analyze it. There is hardly any reference to any, there's no reference to any ism, right? No ism is mentioned. No structuralism, post-structuralism, nothing like that, right? I don't even mention modernism, I don't think. So I've tried to steer clear of what I think are the academic obsessions with structure and process and so on. And I've tried to highlight the story, the characters, the depiction of Irish history, the Bloom's quality as a character. And I argue that Bloom is like, he's meant to be a 20th century everyman, but he's also a 21st century everyman. Because of his attitudes, which are attitudes we need today. Attitudes of moderation and, you know, he's not the most intelligent man in the world, but he takes a serious interest in life and he tries to work things out for himself. He doesn't go with the crowd. He doesn't engage in ranting and raving like some of his fellow Dubliners do. He's this measured, prudent individual, except on one occasion in the book when he cuts loose. And that, for me, is at the heart of the book, but people may disagree. Everyone has their own favorite bit of Ulysses. But my favorite bit is when Bloom is in Barney Kiernan's pub on Little Britain Street in the Cyclops episode. He goes there because he's trying to fix the insurance policy, the payout of the insurance policy for Paddy Dignam's family. So he's being the, you know, the good Samaritan. He's being the humane individual who's trying to do the right thing for his friend's family. Okay? And he gets into an argument. Most of the people in the pub, Bloom is smoking a cigar. Most of them are drinking. And they're getting more and more lively in their conversation as the episode wears on. And by the way, Barney Kiernan's pub is situated in Little Britain Street, which seems to me to be an extraordinary joke by choice about, you know, a discussion of Irish nationalism takes place in Little Britain Street. This is a kind of part of the humor, I think, if you listen. But anyway, Bloom is an object of suspicion because he's a different kind of person from the others. He's not betting on the horses the way they are. They're all obsessed with the Gold Cup running that day, won by a 20 to 1 outsider throwaway. Bloom is not. He's not interested in that at all. They suspect him also because they know he's Jewish, or he was Jewish. His father was Jewish. And he's got a Hungarian background. He's not, you know, he's not a Norman. He's not your regular Irishman of that kind. So he's pursued. And he's asked the question, Mr. Bloom, what's a nation? And he says, a nation is the same people living in the same place. And then they laugh at him, of course, for that. They say, oh, sure, I'm living in the same place. I'm a nation then. And then they ask him, the citizen, who's this kind of robust, one-eyed nationalist. It's a lampoon. It's not fair to Michael Cusack, who is the subject of us. He says, what is your nation, if I may ask, Mr. Bloom? And Bloom says, Ireland. I was born here, Ireland. And that was an answer to the kind of ethnic nationalism that was so rampant at that time, not just in Ireland, by the way, but all over Europe. When Joyce was writing this novel, people were slaughtering each other on the battlefields of Europe, all on the basis of this souped-up ethnic nationalism. And then Bloom cuts loose and says, force, hatred, history. That is no life for man or woman. When it's the opposite of hate we need. And someone says, what do you mean? He says, love. So you have Bloom, this 20th century Irishman with an exotic background, arguing the case against force, hatred, and history. Against the burden of history. The ethno-nationalism of that time. And arguing in favor of a different approach to life, an approach based on love. A Christian approach, of course, but of course that was not the way in which people thought at that time.
Can I ask you, Dan, that's really fascinating. That's great. Thank you for sharing that. Really, really great to hear about your favourite pieces and your rendering and explanation there are so wonderful to engage with. In this instance, Ulysses is your tool in terms of essentially in a way kind of off the back as well of what you've just remarked on, breaking down barriers, you know, soft power diplomacy, as you, I think you referred to it earlier. But this isn't the first engagement that you've taken on in this vein. Anyone familiar with your profile or who follows you on social media, you've really carved out a niche for yourself or a kind of a space in which you're using I suppose mainly Irish poetry, but Irish literature writ large as part of your, I guess, day-to-day work as a diplomat and in this instance, you know, like one of the most esteemed and high-profile Irish diplomats in the United States and beyond. Can you tell us a little bit about why you started doing that? And I suppose, Dan, to remark that these kinds of approaches have become probably more mainstream than they were I think when you started this. So I'd love you to contextualize that a little bit.
Okay, I have two stories to tell you. One of which is in the book, the other one's not. But I'll tell you both because one of them is about Joyce, the other one's about Yeats. In 1981, I was a young diplomat in Delhi. I was 25 years of age. And I met an Indian academic whose name was Shaman Nahal. And look him up. He's since deceased, but he wrote a fantastic book about the partition of India. It's called Azadi. And it's a really brilliant book. But he was an academic, and he was an enthusiast for Yeats. And I got to know him. He was an older guy, probably 20, 25, 30 years older than me at the time, but we became friendly. And he invited me to give two talks at the All India English Teachers Annual Conference taking place that year in New Delhi. I turned up at this venue at the University of Delhi. The attendance was 1,500 people, teachers from all over India. I spoke about Yeats, then I gave a separate talk about Joyce. This was 82, actually, so it was the centenary of Joyce's birth. So it was, and you know, when I talk about Yeats, my talk was about Yeats and the idea of a national literature, which of course, very relevant to India, where the question of is it possible to have a national literature in a country as vast as India, or not, and if it is possible, well, which language should it be written in? Hindi, Tamil, Urdu, whatever, you know. So I felt that those issues were really relevant, and they were, because I got a great response to it. I gave a talk about James Joyce and the Ireland of his time, about Joyce and Parnell and so forth. Anyway, at the end of it, a young woman came over to me to talk to me, and she was a teacher, and she was from the northeastern corner of India. I think it was Nagaland or maybe Assam, one of these, there are seven states up there in the northeastern part of India. And they're very remote, and I've never been there. I, you know, it wasn't a place you got to very often. But And she said to me that she was teaching Joyce to her students in Nagaland, right? She was teaching a portrait of the artist as a young man. And she said she didn't actually, had never had a, never seen a copy of the novel. She was teaching on the basis of stencils or whatever, of excerpts from the novel. So I gave her my novel. I said, here, take this. Take it back with you. And I'll never forget that. It was just a kind of a moment of, it was an epiphany, as Joyce would probably say. Here was this young woman, young teacher, from the remotest part of India, who was teaching a writer from our country in the 1980s to local kids from that very, very remote part of India with a very unusual history and ethnicity, because those people are not like the, you know, they're not like the Hindi speakers in the plains, or they're mountain people and so forth. So that for me was an eye opener. And then the second one, which I do mention in the book, was I was invited once to have lunch with Vijayalakshmi Pandit, who was the grandmother of a friend of mine, Geeta Sehgal, and Mrs. Pandit was Nehru's sister. So she had been ambassador for India to the UN, to Moscow, and to London, where she had covered Ireland from London. And when we sat down to lunch at her home in the Golfling suburb of New Delhi, she said, oh, you're Irish. And I said, yes. She said, I would arise and go now and go to Innisfree in a small cabin built there of clay and wattles made. And she recited the entire poem by heart. And then she went on to recite, when you were old and grey and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and all their shadows deep. And I said, Mrs. Pandit, where did you learn those poems? She said, when I was interned by the British with my brother during the 1930s. And Yeats was a nationalist and we admired him and we've never forgotten him. Again, I had this kind of penny drop moments. But I thought, here's a representative of the most significant, prominent family in India of the entire 20th century. And she is a fan of the writings of William Butler Yeats. And that's why today I'm the honorary president of the Yeats Society, because I realized at that time what a national treasure we possess in Yeats and Joyce. And I've carried those lessons with me through my career. And when I was in London, for example, I was there for the 150th anniversary of the birth of W.B. Yeats, and I did a lot of talking. That's when I started doing my daily poetry tweets, and I've continued them for the last 6 years, and we'll keep them going for as long as I can. But it was all, I go back to that experience with Mrs. Pandit, with Nehru's sister, back in Delhi in 1982, as the kind of the foundation stone of my understanding that literature, that our literature has a value for Ireland beyond the aesthetic standard that it sets, beyond the literary achievement that's embedded in those works of art. They have a value to Ireland as introducing us, helping to tell our story to a wider world, which otherwise would probably know little or nothing about us, because we are a small country and we don't command global attention, but through our literature, we have managed to have a footprint far greater than we could ever have hoped to have without that literary output of such quality from 100 years ago. I only hope that in this century, we can produce works of similar quality that will engage people in our century, in today's century, with Ireland for the future.
May I ask you, Dan, following on from that, how do I'm pretty sure from conversations I've been privy to with you or engaged with you in the past that your day-to-day job as the ambassador for Ireland in the United States, you engage with other ambassadors and diplomats of a certain, you know, high standing. How do your colleagues at that level are there other examples of diplomats, you know, engaging in these kinds of ways with the literature and history of their countries and backgrounds, and or if not, then how do your peers at that level engage with what you do, either specifically through, you know, this publication and your poetry, blogging and social media presence and everything like that, and more generally?
Yeah, well, last year when we had to do our Bloomsday virtually, I actually asked six of my colleagues, my European colleagues here, because my point was that this is a great European novel, and I would like you to read an excerpt from the novel which refers to your country. So I had the EU ambassador read the part about forced hatred history, the one that I mentioned earlier from the Cyclops chapter. I had the Cypriot ambassador read from the first episode that talks about you and I, Kinch, can do something for this island, Hellenize it. I had him read that, you know, the kind of stuff about the, you know, the desire to Hellenize Ireland. I had the French ambassador read from the Scylla and Charybdis episode, which has some French in it. I had the German ambassador read from the same episode with a reference to Goethe, and she did it brilliantly, because the reference is to Wilhelm Meister, Goethe's novel. And she had inherited from her great-grandfather, who was a distinguished German historian and literary man, and a first edition of Goethe's Wilhelm Meister, and she read from that.
Wow.
So all of them, and the Italian ambassador, read the bit which has Italian in it in the Wandering Rocks episode. So all of them entered the spirit of it with great gusto. They all enjoyed it. In fact, my European colleague said to me, he said, I love you and I hate you for making me do that. He said, it was so much work. I had to work on it because I'm not a native English speaker, although his English is brilliant, but he said, I'm not a native, so I had to work on it. He said, I spent hours and hours. But he said, I loved it. You know? So I think, look, I mean, different people have different personalities, right? And I am adamant that every ambassador has to do the job in their own way. You know, this is why we change ambassadors every 4 or 5, 6 years, because you need a new broom. You need someone to come in fresh, because the risk is that you stay too long, you kind of get too used to the place you're living in and you don't see it anymore in the way you should. So, and every ambassador will have a different way of approaching things depending on their own background, their own experience and their own aptitudes. And I'm fully convinced that there's no ideal way, there's no gold standard for the way you do ambassadorial work. I've just hit on this particular model. But mind you, most of my work is not on social media. Most of my work is talking to people within the administration, in businesses and so on, which I don't even mention on social media because
It
doesn't benefit from being talked about publicly. But that's where most of my work is. I mean, I spend a lot of time talking to congressmen, for example. If the congressman is someone that has an Irish, a district with a strong Irish American, they'll be happy to have a photograph with me to show to their constituents that they're meeting the Irish ambassador. So that's a positive thing. So sometimes I do go on social media, but most of the time talking to congressmen, it's all confidential and it doesn't require and wouldn't benefit from being mentioned on social media.
Yeah, but the social media, you know, your presence in that vein, Dan, I think is so impactful in terms of reaching in and making visible, I suppose, in your instance, the way you showcase and are so committed to showcasing this immense literary output. It's funny how much have you, and I'll wrap up soon, and thank you for being so generous with your time with me today, Dan. Have you caught, as someone who wears a historian's hat as well, how much have you thought about the milestone of the centenary, Dan, when we think about Ulysses and where we are as a society and as a people 100 years out from the publication of this really important work? Are anniversaries important markers for you in terms of, you know, some history? I happen to be someone who likes anniversaries. I love the motivation of that kind of mark. And it's kind of a false one in a way, then another, and other historians don't like that kind of motivation behind work at all. Have you thought, how much did that kind of weight of the centenary weigh on you, if at all?
No, absolutely. I mean, my first book was written to mark the millennium. It was a book called A New Day Dawning, A Portrait of Ireland in 1900, and I published it in 1999 to mark the, you know, the arrival of a new century. So, yeah, centenaries, and of course, I did a lot of work in London on the centenary of the Easter Rising, centenary of the Home Rule Bill of 1914, centenary of the Somme, you know. So I and here last year I did a lot of work on the centenary of the War of Independence. I did a series of events, including with NYU, called A Farther Shore, where we looked at the various issues, you know, that arose during the War of Independence. So yeah, I think, look, it seems to me at least that a century is an appropriate block of time to look back over, because the fact is that nobody is still around that lived through the events of a century before, right? So that's the reason why centenaries, I think, make sense. I remember, one of the first things I remember is the 50th anniversary of the Easter Rising. And I remember being, you know, wrapped up in it. I remember watching that program every evening, Insurrection, on the television, and being absolutely absorbed. It probably started me off in my journey as an enthusiast for Irish history. But the fact is that that could not be an honest exercise fully, because there were people still around, a lot of them, who were either veterans of that period themselves or the children of veterans. But once a century has elapsed, that factor disappears. And therefore, I think 2016 was a much more sophisticated and realistic portrayal of our analysis and discussion and dialogue about what happened in 1916. And I think it was a great success, because I remember being in the Department of Foreign Affairs in 2016 and hearing you know, a couple of talks about 1916 from totally different perspectives. One, a very strongly nationalistic perspective, and the other one, a very much a revisionist perspective. And the public who were there were just fascinated by it. They weren't hostile. The person that gave the kind of, you know, sharp critique of the Easter Rising didn't get booed, didn't get jeered, didn't get hassled. It was a sort of respectful interest in what people had to say. So it was possible to ventilate a whole range of analytical frameworks for dealing with 1916. And when it comes to Ulysses, of course, it's a different story. But I think, for me at least, in celebrating Ulysses, I'm celebrating also the centenary of our state. Because I do see a kind of a connection, because the kind of world that James Joyce aspired to, the kind of Ireland that I think he would have liked to see coming into being, is not far from what we have today. I know he would not be able to contemplate really the you know, the changes, but nonetheless, insofar as Joyce was an opponent of sort of extremes, someone with humane values, the kind of values that Leopold Bloom exhibits in Ulysses, I think those are values that are pretty familiar to people today and that Irish people are pretty comfortable with. So I do think that the fact that we now celebrate Ulysses in the way we do is a mark of how far we've come. Because if you read the reviews of Ulysses in 1922-23, it was a far cry, and the attitude was very hostile towards what Joyce was trying to do, not just in Ireland, by the way, across the world. He was seen as this kind of, you know, muckraker who was trying to, you know, deconstruct civilization and recreate it in his own tawdry image. And now I think we now appreciate what Joyce was trying to do. And I think it no longer offends us. It now enthralls us. And that's why I'd like to see more people have a look into Ulysses, or at least try to introduce themselves to it through my book. this year, which is why I've put pen to paper and published this book, Ulysses, A Reader's Odyssey.
Well, Dan, thank you so much. And again, congratulations. Such a pleasure to have the honour of speaking to you as Ireland's ambassador to the United States. The book is available from January 14th is the official publication date. For people watching and listening, the publication end of it in terms of the cover and the layout of the book is really brings you in, and I think is in keeping with the spirit of attracting not just academics and not like the general reader, but I hope as well our colleagues in academic circles will appreciate the intervention as well in terms of what you set out to do and how you bring it into dialogue with your own journeys yourself. Congratulations again, Dan. And is it too soon to ask if there's another project on your horizon? Or
yeah, I always have lots of projects on my horizon. I never stop. I have an active mind, and it doesn't stop after I finish work. These days, of course, you know, we're back again to a pretty curtailed lifestyle with limited activity. So I am already working on a short biography of W.B. Yeats I want to bring out for the centenary of Yeats's Nobel Prize next year.
Oh, wonderful.
Because that prize was a recognition not just of Yeats, but of Ireland.
Yeah. Oh, that's fabulous. Okay, we're looking forward to hearing more about that. But really, congratulations, Dan. And again, thank you. And for, you know, the year that will be in it, and there will be more publications coming out. This is a wonderful publication to kind of set the tone and kick us off. And thanks again, Dan, and best of luck. And we'll see you soon, please, Dan.
Thank you.
Dawn.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Knighton Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Remember that next week we will be back, same time, same place. We are always very happy to have you here on This Irish American Life. And thank you for being with us for another week. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records. And this broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Luxman Ireland House, NYU, was paid for by Luxman Ireland House, NYU, in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited.